His outrageous characters have delighted generations of American film goers and television viewers. His life's work is now the subject of a retrospective at the American Museum of the Moving Image. Joining me now for a conversation about his life and about his creatures is the creator of Bugs Bunny and Wile E. Coyote and the Roadrunner and Daffy Duck and Pepe Le Pew. His name is, as you know, Chuck Jones, and I'm very pleased to have him here. Welcome, sir.
Well, sir.
Well, in your 82nd year, which you're very proud of, and as you said, Warner Bros. Will not ever allow you to go away.
Well, no money. I'm not proud of being 82, just so as I am. So lacking anything else to be proud of, I can be proud of that.
When did you create Bugs Bunny?
Well, actually, Bugs was an unusual rabbit, where most rabbits have hundreds of children, and Bugs actually had three or four people who were involved in his growth. Tex Avery, Prince Freeling, and I probably had as much to do with him as anybody. So I don't know how much distinction there is to being the father of a rabbit or a duck or a coyote for that matter. And probably much better than being a mother of one. Getting birth to a duck, maybe I guess.
Yeah, that's
like a porcupine or something.
It would be worse. Now, you said that Bugs, you were saying he acts crazy.
In the first one, which caught some of the essence because it was the first time the rabbit ever said, "What's up, Doc?" That was a wild hair in 1940, that Tex Avery directed.
Right.
And Bugs in that picture and four or five successive pictures was crazy. I mean, didn't know what was going to happen. The director didn't know, the writers didn't know, and so anything went. But we soon discovered that in humor, it's... the more a person is playing at being crazy, the funnier it is.
Yeah.
We know that Harpo Marx isn't crazy, we know that Groucho isn't, but then the limitations begin to move in, the thing that makes the character, the perimeters, as they now call them, perimeter, or they were in my day, they enclose the character so that it becomes that one thing. And Groucho Marx said that humor isn't so much what you do as what you don't do.
Yeah.
So that, I mean, it is true that the more you narrow the character down, the better it gets. The more fat you can pull out.
Mm-hmm.
You have to forget all the adjectives and so on. You remember pronouns,
because
Daffy at one point says, "I know what went wrong. Pronoun trouble." Well, I never thought that would be a laugh. I don't know why. The loving line.
That's the way you say it.
Well, okay. The thing, what I meant by that is that a funny line in humor is different than wit. A stand-up comedian is witty.
Mm-hmm.
Humor is the process of a comedian. The telling is funny in itself.
Mm-hmm.
The situation makes the line funny. I mean, if you came home one day and you were in a front yard and you opened the front gate and you walked in and you found somebody standing in your front door with the door open shooting a shotgun into your living room, well, naturally, you would go seek help. And I would seek help very quickly and very fast under situations like that. But Bugs doesn't do that, does he?
No.
Knocks up and taps the guy on the shoulder, looks over his shoulder to see what's going on around here, you know. And he says, he takes a bite of the carrot, "What's up, Doc?" "I'm shooting rabbits, you know." And so, are those lines funny? They are now, only because of usage.
And because of the character.
But, you know, it was one of those things. Tex Avery used "What's up, Doc?" because he was raised in a little town called Tyler, Texas.
Yeah.
And in Tyler, Texas, the common usage would be Doc was the term, or in Connecticut it might be Mac, or any New York taxi driver can tell you if you do something he doesn't like, he'll call you Jack.
Yeah, what's up?
That's not an affection.
No.
Anyway,
no.
Look, Jack, you know, why don't you know you're going?
Yeah.
And so, I suppose, so each area probably has its own use.
Yeah, what's Tex
Pal? Yeah, Pal's another one.
Right.
And Pal may be affectionate, Jack is not.
Right.
And Buster is far from that.
And
my wife calls me Buster when I...
When she's not speaking to you with great favor.
She's always taking me with great favor. At my age, so I'd kill me if she didn't.
I'm sure you've asked this 1,000 times, but let me just, because if I don't do this, the audience who's watching us now will be disappointed. What is the character that is most endearing to you? Which one means the most to you?
It's not necessarily the most endearing, but...
Yeah, I knew you'd find a different word.
Well, no, it isn't that. I mean, I do care for the... But you see, you have to care for all the characters. You can't have a favorite. Mm. If you have children, like if you have children, you're going to have a favorite, but you better not expose the community to that favoritism, because then you'll be in serious trouble. There'll be war. So the same thing there. I feel that if I express myself to my feeling about one character, but I'll tell you this, I feel most at home with Daffy Duck or the Coyote than I do with Bugs, because Bugs is a comic hero. Well, very few of us are comic heroes or feel comfortable around them. How many are there in live action? From the very beginning, it's the losers that dominate the scene.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody from Chaplin to Jackie Gleason are all losers.
But they dominate.
Sure, but it's the same thing that the humor is always based on the loser. And that's why we understand them so much more than we would otherwise.
You were telling me as we were watching this that the music is obviously the, you know, you don't make any edits in the music, and the dance is very difficult to do.
Well, we might make edits because we actually did take the 14 hours of the Ring of the Nibelung and squash it down to 6 minutes, but the music is honest. It's played with a full orchestra, and we're not fooling around with the music. As such, in the Coyote and Roadrunner, we would. Oddly enough, the music of the chase music is from Shvetna's The Bartered Bride. And believe me, it's difficult for me not to call it The Battered Bird. But there's pretty elegant stuff goes on in there.
Yeah. Let me take a look to understand the process. I mean, how do you go about this thing of animation?
Well, for one thing, you fall into it, and everyone I know in animation is doing his own world. The law that I feel is pretty necessary in creative work, and that is if you enjoy what you're doing, the chances are you didn't start out to do it. There were no schools of animation when I went to Chouinard Art Institute, now called Cal Arts, and I studied drawing, the human figure, and it turned out it was the best possible education. That's exactly what you do now. The reason being that in animation, you can't have a style, an obvious one at any rate. In a comic strip, you have to have one because you have to have your comic strip recognized from other comic strips. But an animator will have to animate, or an animation director, which I was an animator, must be able to move from drawing How the Grinch Stole Christmas to Ricky Tikki Tavi to the White Seal to a whale to an elephant to a three-toed sloth, whatever is called for. So you have to have a very slippery individual, able to move from role to role.
What makes a cartoon great?
Well, I think what makes any piece of drama great is the audience recognizing, in perhaps an exaggerated way, their own problems that they encounter. And this may seem a little presumptuous, but as I said, comedy is concerned with small things. The sort of thing that I am familiar with, you are familiar with, that is how to get something to eat, how to get someplace to sleep, how to get your girl, how to get a boy, anything, you know. All these things are very important. And as Jackie Gleason said, drama, it is the most exact drama, form of drama, perhaps, in comedy, because there's an instant critic, laughter. If you're doing tragedy, how do you know? You go down and check whether people are...
You have to see who's crying, who's crying, has an emotional
cry meter
response.
You put little things on people's eyes, you know, catch them out there, weigh it afterward, divide it by the number of people, and then people can tell how many handkerchiefs you can sell next year.
Yeah.
But it doesn't quite work that way. You have to know, and to do it in advance, because people don't quite understand, those who work on stage, when they try out in different places and see whether the comedy works or not. Well, in many films, it's an entirely different matter.
Mm. Have you had a role model? I mean, I know you have great affection for Mark Twain.
It's more than affection.
It's
God.
Well, why Mark Twain?
Well, I came... my father was a rather interesting bird. There were four children, and he taught us all to read when we were 3 years old.
Yes.
And I was 3 years old at any rate. And his contention was that since we could learn to walk, we obviously had abilities. He could certainly learn a simple thing like these pictographs, all words. So we all learned to read very early. And one of my early books that I read when I was maybe 4 years old was Uncle Wiggily. And then I was looking around the house, and I came across a one called Uncle Daniel. You know,
yeah.
I figured that must be a sequel to Uncle Wiggily.
not the same,
right? No, not exactly. And the guy couldn't spell Alexander either. He spelled it with a K.
Yeah.
But at any rate, I came to my mother. I said, this is very dull stuff. I mean, what's it doing?
Yeah.
Well, I wasn't quite ready for it. In fact, I never was ready for it until I saw this new film. Yeah. And
right.
Never
loved it.
And then I saw it. I began to understand what it was all about because it was too beautiful. I wouldn't have understood it when I was young.
Yeah.
Because to a great extent, I very often don't understand everyday people.
But you liked Harold Bloom, you told me.
Huh?
You liked Harold Bloom, the first guest here.
Oh, yeah. Well, but I liked him, I respected him, but I probably wouldn't understand him.
Right? Oh, I bet you would.
Yeah, well, I mean,
yeah. Let me just say this, because I don't want to lose this, because a couple of times, one of the things is, and I love this quote, this was about your uncle, and what you had said, I was so ashamed of my drawings, I told my uncle, it's no good, you can't make a racehorse out of a pig, talking about your drawings. And what did your uncle say?
My uncle said, no, but you can make a very fast pig. So that's what it made us. That's really what I became.
A very fast pig.
You see, the thing he says, you cannot... Self-approbation is one of the dumbest things you can do. I mean, they may give you momentary satisfaction, so you're good at something.
Right.
Or as Robert Frost one time told a young man who came to him and showed him some work, and Frost said, what do you do? And the boy said, I'm a poet. And then Frost said something, and the boy, this is emblazonness across your eyeballs. He said, the term poet is a gift word. You can't give it to yourself.
Yeah,
so I can only say that when I say to another animator, boy, you can really animate,
That's
the greatest thing that happened to him. I know Frank Lloyd Wright, that was a wonderful story about him. He said that he called himself, he said, I make houses. I make buildings of people and so on. He would never allow people to use the world's greatest architect or architect at all.
Yeah, there's no doubt he thought he was.
Well, it was proven because he appeared at a trial in Pittsburgh, they said, and the bailiff swore him in. What is your occupation? He said, I'm the world's greatest architect. And the reporters came storming up to him afterwards and said, you know, you've never said that before. How dare you? And he said, I was under oath. But that won't matter. I to say somebody can draw well. I remember one of our producers was standing by one time. We were talking about this fellow Paul Zurgin, who drew beautifully, and he said, somebody said, boy, Zurgin can really draw. This man came by and says, of course he can draw. He's an artist, isn't he? That's what he thought.
I remember when Laurence Olivier died, and they said, what was it you like to say about you? And he said that I was a good craftsman, like a good plumber.
You bet, and he was the best. And the actor is of that quality is very similar to what an animation director has to be. You have to move from role to role. Because you have to, it isn't like with Charlie Brown or something, you take a cartoon strip, put it on the film, but that's different.
Yeah. You've got a new character coming out too, did you tell me?
It'll be out next week. It's called A New Roadrunner and Coyote, the first new one in 30 years, called Chariots of Fur.
Yeah. Why do you have this pen in your hand and this pencil?
It's a pencil, but the difference is if a pen has a point on it, it's full of ink.
Yes.
It's just full of ideas.
Oh! Do you have one you can put on paper?
Well, fast pig, or would you like to order?
Fast pig would be great. Yeah.
I'll tell you what I'll do a coyote and a pig. I'm very fast. I'm not good, but I'm terribly fast. You know, a coyote is...
Yeah.
Anybody can draw a coyote's nose and his tongue is usually hanging out. Body just comes in like this, lower jaw. And you'll note something that he always carries a knife and fork with him just in case.
Right.
And he's obviously one of the world's greatest optimists. And there's a knife and fork. He has a very scraggly tail. He wanted to know that he was going to be making a scraggly tail and a nice furry tail, and she'd make everything go inward rather than outward. Yeah. If you're making a Disney squirrel, you make a tail like this. See, I make it like this. That's one of the real tricks. All you have to know is that. Actually, that makes him fat. He shouldn't be fat. Yeah. The simplest way to draw a coyote is to learn how to make dust and then hang a coyote on it. I used to have a beautiful signature.
What happened?
Well, when you come out of art school, you think the first thing you look for is a signature.
Yeah.
So you used to get a very fancy one. Yeah. Right? Something like, I mean, something that was...
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, this kind of thing?
Right.
And then you, like this, then you always put a brush through it to show that you're an artist. Like that. I don't know what that represents, but...
And that's what happened when you came out of...
Oh, yeah, it was beautiful, but I couldn't draw it.
You say in this you record the music first.
Yes.
You know, and then photograph to it, or...
Well, it's just like a dancer, yeah. Or any other dancer. But actually, a good animator, working in full speed, working for a director, can do perhaps 15 seconds of screen time a week with the help of an assistant.
How much?
15 seconds a week. And that at Disney's probably 8 seconds.
And what's the hardest part of it? Why does Disney take longer?
The hardest part is learning how to draw in the first place.
Yeah, that's a good start, isn't it? Yeah.
Well, there really isn't anything that's particularly different than anything else. But when you learn to live in a quite a different time thing, you know.
Yeah.
Because you're dealing with something, as I said, you're dealing with 15 seconds a week. Because for the director, he's dealing in a minute a week, because he turns out one cartoon every probably 5 weeks. Something like that.
Has animation and cartoons become an art form? I mean, did it at some point become an art form?
Again, I think we'll have to go to the outside. That will prove itself historically, whether or not it's an art form.
What do you think?
Well, I don't have the strength of character that Frank Lloyd Wright does.
You're under oath there, Mr.
No,
Jones.
Well, I like to
Who's the greatest cartoonist of all?
I like to believe it's a form of expression that people like.
Yeah.
Well, that's art or not, I do not know. But it seems to me there are worse occupations than spending your life making people laugh.
There are. There certainly are. Fast pig.
I'd have to do that, don't
I? Yeah, of course you will. Yeah. What would you do if you draw this fast pig? What would you do differently if you were just starting out in this wonderful career you've had and all this?
Would I do differently?
Yeah.
I don't know. I'd probably. Well, let me put it this way. You know about Dorothy Parker's put on all her gravestone?
I do, but I forgot. Let me just take a second.
Excuse my dust.
That's right.
what I would like to be able to do right now is to go back and take some of my pictures and cut them up and make banjo picks out of them.
You didn't like them, huh?
No, not I wasn't the only one who didn't like them. My disliking them was, I don't like any, you know, when you first finish anything, as you know, you really don't like it very well.
We're not talking about an art form, but I've never seen an interview that I didn't think could have been made better.
Oh, of course. That's the whole point. I mean, you know, to put it rather elegantly, frustration is the handmaiden of creativity.
Yeah.
I like that one.
I like that.
I do what I can.
Which characters have aspects of you? All of them?
Yeah, and you might say that, again, I'd like to refer to Olivier or Guinness. You step into the role because it appeals to you. I become Daffy Duck. George Orwell said, I never met a man worse than I am. Right?
<Yeah. laughs>
So that would mean that he understood that Daffy.
Yeah. Well, what was it that Twain said about liking myself? I mean, I even know, was that quote about... Something that Mark Twain said about liking myself. I've got that somewhere too. There was a wonderful quote that Mark Twain had about himself, liking himself. I can't remember the name.
It doesn't matter.
Tell me more about Twain and why he was God for you.
Well, let me try to explain it this way. That the father was on, whenever we'd go rent a house, we'd rent a house with a lot of books in it. those days you could do things like that. People moved to like the books.
Right.
I don't know why. Because everybody had books, I guess. And we move into a house, he'd find a house that had a lot of books. That was a furnished house, too. It might not have furniture,
right, but
it had books.
Right.
So we moved into a house when I was about five, I guess. And had had a complete set of Mark Twain.
Yeah.
Well, I walked up and I opened Tom Sawyer. Tom. Where is it? Tom. That's Ollie calling him.
Yeah.
And I was, boy, I stabbed him to the heart. I grabbed him and put it around, you know, and running off and hit him. Other people would grab juniors, you know.
Yeah.
But something happened at that moment. And from that point on, Mark Twain, I know of nothing that ever was important to me that could not be solved by finding something he said. He said, recently, when I can kind of get political, he said, reader, let us suppose that you are a congressman. Then let us suppose that you are an idiot. But, he said, I repeat myself. Absolutely. Cheers. Right on. Right on. Right on. You ever heard of that? Without Dan McKinnock, the point is, who the hell ever heard of Mark Twain?
Yeah.
Trusting anybody.
Now listen to what Ray Bradbury said about you. This was at his 55th birthday party, and there was an unusual question about what do you want to be when you grow up, and he said, I want to be 14 years old like Chuck Jones.
Yeah, well, but of course I was 60 then.
Perhaps that will be my most apt possible epithet.
I'll be all right. I won't mind that.
Yeah, what would you like yours to be?
Well, I can tell you what I wanted Ray's to be, and he didn't like it very much.
What do you want Ray's to be?
X-ray.
He didn't like that at all.
He didn't want it. Of course, that's straightforward. Nobody can be confused.
No, he's gone.
X-ray.
X-ray.
So said,
out of here. You know, the former right.
Well,
what do you want yours to be?
I don't know. I collect these things, but I remember I wish I had lived the kind of life that would allow me to have one that Stevenson wrote for himself. Do you remember that?
No. Adley Stevenson
Stevenson. Okay. He said, under the wide and starry sky, dig my grave and let me lie, glad that I live and gladly die, and I lay me down with a will. Here be the verse you quote for me, here he lies where he longed to be, home as a sailor, home from the sea, and a hunter, home from the hill. Well, I can't think of anybody that wouldn't be happy with that.
No, I would be very happy with
that. And he wrote it, and that was on Samoa, and afterward, while the natives had grown to love him, he was only 37.
Didn't he die when he was 37?
Yeah, and so they carried him to the top of the hill and buried him on the hill, and they engraved it on the rock.
Have you seen it?
No, but I'm satisfied with it.
Yeah, I am.
And I just as well did.
Let me just talk about the characters for a second before, because I want to just get some sense of.
If you're looking for logic, you're jumping up the wrong way. God, what an IM person. You're not supposed to be logical.
Yeah, I know. Well, I'm not.
Come on, I'm in trouble now.
Just describe the characters when I just say the names. Uh-huh. Bugs Bunny.
A cross between Professor Higgins, Dorothy Parker, and Errol Flynn. You better go much further.
No, okay, no, Peppy.
Well, Peppy is when I was in school, you have to say what Peppy isn't, but that's what I was when I was in school. I was 6 feet 2 inches tall and weighed 122 pounds, so I didn't have when you looked at me frontwards, I looked like an axe. I had a side view, but if I walked down the hall, a girl would wave, she was weighing somebody behind me, because I was like a spring hanging off the ceiling. So, I waved back, but Chris didn't see me. So my days in high school were unfortunate, to say the least, at least from that viewpoint. Seduction did not appeal to me. All I wanted to do was to be seen. It's a simple ambition.
You weighed 110, did you?
No, I weighed 120, but anything. But anyway, so I guess when I got a chance to develop a character, he was completely sure of himself, and I could put it on the screen. Because it's not me, but at least I had the advantage of knowing here's a guy who was completely sure of himself. And what could be less appropriate than a skunk? So I decided to make him a very sexy female skunk, and a male skunk who was always looking. And I was making a slight case in misogyny.
Misogyny, right.
Or misogyny of 1994, 95, whatever.
How about Daffy?
Well, Daffy, of course, is every book. I mean, he's me, and he's you, and he's everybody else. Everybody recognizes Daffy and sympathizes with Daffy. But Daffy rushes in and fears to tread at the same time. Probably as good a thing as you can do. Give me another one. You want to talk about my producers?
Yeah, right. Do you write for children, or do you write for adults?
I don't write for either one.
You write for yourself?
Well, I don't have much choice in the matter. I think everybody does, and if you try to, you know, and again, it's always funny to see, they tell you what the audience looks like and so on. Come on, nobody knows what an audience looks like, and if you do, you'd commit suicide. So when we started out, we didn't know. We thought, children, I don't know. So since they went into theaters, we couldn't assume that the people that went to see I Was a Fugitive from a Chain Gang would be children. But on the other hand, our experience with adults was that they were very admirable either. So we decided to lacking anybody else to write for us. And there were three directors and four or five writers, all very interesting guys, all from different walks of life. And that was curious, too. And all of us had, and all of us were there. So we respected each other. And we loved each other's sense of humor. And so we decided to write for ourselves. And the result was that hoping that the audience would follow. And if the audience didn't follow, as they used to say, we'd be sucking the bricks. Which meant being out of the street.
Yeah, no, we'd be sucking out of the bricks.
That was a long way. You sucked that way.
Yeah. Do you have children?
I have a child who, unfortunately, was fecund. That is, she had three children, and the children had hundreds of them children. So now I have great-grandchildren, and I tell them they can call me great-grandfather if they put a comma beyond great. That's the most wonderful thing ever. But my first wife died about 25 years ago, and when I was making Now the Grinch Stole Christmas with Dr. Seuss, and I'd worked with him during the war, making dreams of them, a lady came to interview me named Marion Dern, who was with TV Guide, and she came over to interview Dr. Seuss. And she, the gal said, well, we've got to bring the director of the film along. Yeah. She said, I don't want to talk to the director of the film. So I want to talk to Dr. Seuss. So we met at lunch, and it was one of those, you may meet a stranger across a crowded table, martinis and stuff. But by the time I took a look at Marion, I said, ooh, this is, I couldn't have her then, because I was married, but I was willing to wait. And I did wait, and I waited about 10 years, and finally we got married, and so it's been 13. We've been going together and married. We tried 7 years to find out whether she could marry me, and we did. Mm-hmm. It was great. But I want to add one thing about that.
Okay.
When people asked me about her, I said that we were childhood sweethearts, but not with each other.
It's a great to have you here. I mean, there are all kinds of things. Chuck Jones, A Flurry of Joy by Hugh Kenner. Chuck Jones, Peter and the Wolf, the 50 greatest cartoons. That's all, folks, the art of Warner Brothers Animation. Chuck Jones, by Chuck Jones, The Life and Times of an Animated Cartoonist. All of those, if you enjoy this, you'll enjoy them. It's great to meet you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. We thank you for joining us this evening, and we hope we'll see you again.